to HCP Live Podcast. I'm Patrick Campbell, Associate Editorial Director of HCP Live, and in this episode, we're spotlighting the first half of 2024 in the field of dermatology with the one and only Dr. James Novos, President of the American Acne and Rosacea Society, as well as the Research Director of JDR Dermatology Research. Del Rosso offers us a deep dive into the news and breakthroughs that define the first 6 months of 2024 for his field. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Del Rosso. Enjoy. Dr. Del Rosso, thank you for joining me. As we prepare to enter the second half of 2024, it has been a very wild for the year, first half of the year, for dermatology specifically. For you, as a leading subject matter expert in dermatology, as you look back on the first 6 months of the year and sort of maybe even a little bit into 2023, what have been the big storylines that have bled over and really carried the field of dermatology during the first 6 months of 2024?
Would you call me a subject matter expert? A leading subject. I'm going to add that to my LinkedIn description. You know, leading subject matter expert. That's new. I'm going to add that to my CV. Thank you very much. Right. I appreciate the opportunity. And yes, I do stay on top a lot of what's going on in dermatology. It's always been something that I've done and I continue to enjoy doing after 37 years of being in the specialty. And it is a very exciting time. It's happening faster than I think most people feel they can actually keep up with, but it's something that we certainly need to do. And it has been a very loud noise level in dermatology, but sometimes it's white noise and sometimes it's real noise. And there's a lot of real high quality information out there in many different areas. So I'll just start by looking at atopic dermatitis. And when we just look at the topical aspects of atopic dermatitis, we have several skincare companies that have put together some excellent skincare products, some specifically directed to eczema, symptomatic dry skin that we often see in atopic dermatitis, that is really important for us to remember the fundamentals of managing atopic dermatitis with gentle cleanser and moisturizers. So those are the basic fundamentals, and not just think about selecting what drug they need and whether they need systemic or just topical. But that being said, when we think about the therapies, we've had topical ruxolitinib Opzelura that has been approved, twice daily application for atopic dermatitis that can be used very effectively in any area that's affected, as long as it's 20% body surface area or less. And one of the concerns has been it's a Janus kinase inhibitor. They put box warnings on the topical, which unfortunately really has not been an issue in terms of toxicities being reported to drug, but that is carried in the label and that has to be dealt with in conversation. But the good news is as we get continued experience, we get more long-term use, we have some real-world data to show that this is a very effective therapy for atopic dermatitis, can be applied anywhere on the skin from mild to moderate. That's the category that's in the FDA-approved label, up to 20% body surface area. And it's been shown to be very well-tolerated, very effective, could be applied to any patient where the eczematous dermatitis is present, and can be used with the expectation that in many patients a rapid reduction in itching, and I think better than what we've had with previously approved non-steroidal agents. And yes, sometimes we might be using corticosteroids in these patients, but with the non-steroidal options that we have, we try to get away from that if we don't need it, or certainly avoid the long-term use. So it's very important to have non-steroidal agents. Now, that being said, topical ruxolitinib is also approved for vitiligo. It's going to take longer, but especially in certain locations like the face, you can often see very, very good results. You're just looking at a matter of months as opposed to a matter of days to weeks with atopic dermatitis. Now, we have two new agents that are both FDA-approved topical agents for psoriasis. We have topical tapinarof applied once a day, that a Vtama cream for plaque psoriasis, and we have topical roflumilast also applied once a day for plaque psoriasis. Both of those are non-steroidal agents, and there's impressive data with both. And I think it's important to look at that data. We don't have time to go into all of it, but these are agents that can be applied for any severity of disease, any place where the disease is present on the body, and can be used as long as you need them. And the advantage there is that if patients are going on and off treatment as they improve and clear up and stop and restart, these agents continue to work and you're not necessarily concerned as you might be with a topical corticosteroid, where they're applying it and for how long. So a big advantage with both of those. They have some unique characteristics that may differentiate them in some situations. We don't have time to go through all of that, but those are two agents that are very important to learn. Now with topical tapinarof, they have done some work, phase four work with intertriginous psoriasis. The drug had always been approved for intertriginous psoriasis, but they didn't have just that specific area being looked at. They now have that phase four data with psoriasis. Now, with topical roflumilast, they have a plethora of data on the safety, the efficacy, and the tolerability. It's a very unique, and I think a very important part of this agent is its vehicle, very, very well designed. And in its evaluation, where it's also been evaluated for seborrheic dermatitis, and also for scalp and body psoriasis with the foam. They have looked at that, even though it's not yet necessarily FDA-approved with the foam for that. Seborrheic dermatitis with the foam formulation. Now, remembering that the foam and the cream are pretty much identical formulations, except the foam is about two-thirds water. The cream is about 50% water. And so the vehicles are a little bit different. The foam is approved for seborrheic dermatitis with a topical roflumilast, which is Zoryve. And that's really been a big advance. Now that we understand that it's more than just malassezia, and we've had a gap in a lot of data and evaluation of seborrheic dermatitis, it's very bothersome to patients. It's often addressed with intermittent topical corticosteroids, or there are some FDA-approved antifungal agents, but there's shampoos being only used on the scalp. There's a device cream that doesn't have a single active that's for the face, let's say, or other areas other than the scalp, because not really formulated for the scalp. Patients are bouncing back and forth, utilizing a variety of different therapies. How long could I use the corticosteroid? They have that hanging over their head. The Zoryve foam, the roflumilast foam, is formulated and studied in all areas where the patient had the seborrheic dermatitis. So yes, the scalp was commonly an area of involvement, but they could have had it on the eyebrows, even going down on the eyelids. They could have had it anywhere on the face, around the ears and the scalp. And in the studies, they had approved efficacy in all the areas that were involved in that patient, to get them to clear or almost clear. And they got many of the patients completely clear fairly quickly, extremely good tolerability. So when we look at topical roflumilast, regardless of whether it's being used for psoriasis, atopic dermatitis, which we'll get to with these two newer non-steroidals, or seborrheic dermatitis, the tolerability has been very favorable. And I think that foam is a big advance, FDA approved, because you have one stop shopping with one formulation that the patient that has seborrheic dermatitis could use anywhere. Now, topical tapinarof, which is Vtama, topical roflumilast, which is Zoryve, are both under evaluation for atopic dermatitis. We're expecting approval pretty quickly with roflumilast, and not too far later with tapinarof. Both of these agents once daily have data submitted. Their phase 3 data is submitted and also out there. and both show very favorable results for atopic dermatitis. Having two non-steroidal agents that may allow us to treat this disease when we're utilizing topical therapy without a corticosteroid, or if we want to use a corticosteroid, using it only for a short burst, is a major advance. And there is some data with roflumilast Cerevre cream that it can be used intermittently once you achieve a successful result. So both of these agents, a lot of new data that has come along. So now let's move on to some other exciting areas. You know, we haven't talked about chronic spontaneous urticaria, which, you know, we called it chronic idiopathic urticaria, CIU. Now we're calling it CSU. It's the same situation. And that's these patients that are plagued with urticaria chronically. So by definition of have had it more than 6 weeks, but many of these patients have it for months to years, where they continue to get hives, itching sporadically, many days of the month, not necessarily every day, but often, annoying the heck out of these people on many levels, and not being able to figure out exactly why they had it. Now, we've had Xolair, omalizumab, for some time, an excellent agent, especially in IgE-dependent urticaria, which is many of the cases. That works very well, but it always had that concern about anaphylaxis and whether you had to give the patient an EpiPen to take home, watch them for a couple of hours in the office. That really made it more difficult in dermatology. And some still carry that concern. However, a lot of that has fallen by the wayside. But there is an oral agent that is not yet FDA approved that is under evaluation, which is a Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So omalizumab, which is Xolair, is very effective and is often used for chronic spontaneous urticaria. It is an injectable agent. It does still carry some of those difficulties in the dermatology offices, though a lot of that has improved. However, there is a new agent, which is given orally, which is not yet FDA approved, but has very impressive data for working rapidly with a very favorable safety profile, and that is remibutinib, which is an oral Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Okay, so maybe a little bit different to what we learned about in dermatology, but it is very effective, and it's given orally, which is something that in dermatology is very favorable, especially if it doesn't carry, you know, needing lab tests or being concerned about a lot of safety issues. And this agent does appear to be pretty clean in that regard. So we're certainly looking forward to that. That's not to say we obviously use a lot of injectable agents, biologics, which are often a good first choice in many situations. We have some for atopic dermatitis. I think in the world of chronic spontaneous urticaria, having this remibutinib oral agent is going to be a major advance in dermatology and is going to be easier with it in dermatology, especially if we're not carrying box warnings and need for laboratory tests. But it's not yet approved, but the data is very, very impressive. That's on chronic spontaneous urticaria. Now, dupilumab, which is a monoclonal antibody given by injection, which we have a lot of experience in atopic dermatitis, in very young age groups, adolescents, adults, extremely effective for atopic dermatitis. And we have a lot of data on that. And we continue to get more data to establish the safety of this agent and even data to show that if patients stop and have to restart, it captures its efficacy in the vast majority of cases. So the information on dupilumab continues to be very, very positive, and it does have approval for other atopic conditions that many patients with atopic dermatitis have, like asthma, like nasal polyps with chronic rhinosinusitis, even esophageal disease, right? That what's what is sometimes plaguing these patients in the GI tract that has an atopic basis. So the dupilumab can almost be a one-stop shopping to also be helping when patients have atopic dermatitis and asthma, nasal polyps, etc. It's helping all of those disease states. Though in dermatology, we're not necessarily managing those other components. So dupilumab continues to be very impressive in that regard. And most of the patients get a very, very good control on dupilumab for atopic dermatitis and these other diseases. So that's important. And it continues to have more information coming. It has its studies evaluated for chronic spontaneous urticaria. The FDA has asked for some additional information, but that is under evaluation for that also as a potential agent that we will have that doesn't carry quite the baggage that omalizumab Xolair does. Dupixent does not, in terms of needing laboratory tests, though with omalizumab you don't necessarily need that, but the concerns about anaphylaxis and some of the other things that have really not plagued dupilumab, but have omalizumab, though they probably were overstated. So that's really good news. Now, dupilumab is also under evaluation for bullous pemphigoid, and that has been a very difficult disease, especially in older patients that typically have it, because we want to avoid corticosteroids, which have often been used to treat that plaguing, blistering disease. So there is a lot of data to show that it is effective. I've had good experience with it, but we don't have FDA approval yet, but hopefully we will get that. Now, that moves us on to another category of drugs that is not limited to atopic dermatitis, but obviously gets a lot of discussion for atopic dermatitis, and that out of the Janus kinase inhibitors. And for atopic dermatitis, we're looking at Janus kinase 1, Janus kinase 2 inhibitors predominantly. And the two that we have that are FDA approved as oral agents are upadacitinib, which is Rinvoq, and abrocitinib, which is Cibinqo. There are some pharmacologic differences between those two agents. They have different daily dosages. They have a little bit different profiles on drug interactions and some of the pharmacologic properties, so they're not identical, but they've both been shown to be very helpful for the same type of patients that we use something like dupilumab for, moderate to severe patients that have been difficult to control with topical therapy and probably have gotten occasional bursts of systemic corticosteroids. So the Janus kinase inhibitors, both of them, are very effective. They have a very rapid reduction in itch. And there is some data emerging that when you look at comparison to dupilumab, they do get patients to a higher bar. We have a lot of data with that, with upadacitinib, showing that if patients have been on dupilumab and maybe they get to a point where you're looking for more, or maybe they don't respond as favorably as you would like to the dupilumab, that's an individual decision with the patient and the clinician. Going to one of the oral Janus kinase inhibitors, you're going to see an increased efficacy in many of those patients. So that's something that we have to offer. But we have to remember, even though their safety continues to be very impressive in a population of patients with atopic dermatitis that don't have as many comorbidities and they're younger, to have some of the risk factors that go along with the box warnings like major cardiovascular events and malignancies and some of the other venous thromboembolism, arterial thromboembolism, and some of these other concerns appear to be very low. The data does show that, and sometimes similar to the general population, but that they still are things we have to monitor for and do lab tests with the Janus kinase inhibitors. And the information on how to do that is out there and is something that should not really keep dermatologists from considering them, because there are definitely patients that are going to benefit. Also, there's some newer data with upadacitinib that has really taken a look at patient-reported outcomes. Because when we look at efficacy in the phase two and phase three trials. For example, with atopic dermatitis, we're looking at the primary endpoints are clear or almost clear, the visible appearance of the eczematous dermatitis, and the EASI score, which is basically adding up different components of the disease, the amount of lichenification, the amount of erythema, also taking into the factor of pruritus is typically evaluated as an important endpoint, but not so much how the patient is feeling about their improvement. Those are typically secondary endpoints, and they sort of fall by the ways. What is being collected with upadacitinib, which I think is very important, is correlating things like not only an EASI 75, which is a typical endpoint in studies for atopic dermatitis, 75% reduction in the EASI score. We're looking at EASI 90 and EASI 100. So as we develop newer agents, we're raising the bar to get the patients to clear or at least almost clear, very minimal disease, and getting their itch to zero or very little. Those are going to be the happiest patients. And what's being done, and some, I think, very interesting way of looking at it, that the upadacitinib researchers and people that work with that drug are looking at, are correlating what you can report with an EASI 90 or EASI 100 with how much actual patient-reported outcome improvement that you get. And that is getting the patients to clear or almost clear, right? And little to no itching, right? So the correlation between those, the staunch physical evaluations that we use, what the disease appears like, married to how the patients feel about it, is really extremely important. And that's a very exciting thing that's coming to light with data that's being developed or emerging with upadacitinib. And abrocitinib also has a lot of very important evaluations. Now, taking it one step back in talking about the monoclonal antibodies, we do have monoclonal antibodies, one that's already FDA approved and one that we're anticipating FDA approval very soon, that inhibit IL-13, interleukin-13, which is a very important cytokine operative in patients with atopic dermatitis. And when we hear about cytokines like, oh, I inhibit IL-13, I inhibit IL-31, dupilumab is IL-4 and IL-13, we have to remember that cytokines do not operate in a vacuum. So we don't go to look at one cytokine as solving, even two cytokines sometimes, as solving all the problems, because many cytokines play a role in the disease. That being said, anti-IL-13 alone has shown excellent results in patients with atopic dermatitis. We have tralokinumab, which recently now has an auto-injector available, so you could administer fewer injections. That was one of the problems with it. It required more injections because of the amount of drug that was in a given syringe. The auto-injector is recently available. That's a big advance. And tralokinumab is approved in adolescents now, not only adults. So you now have approval in adolescents. We know that with the adults, you start it every 2 weeks, similar to how you would utilize dupilumab, different dosing, but every 2 weeks. And once you get out to a point that the patient has a high level of improvement, that typically is going to be about 12 to 16 weeks, you can then try to go out to every 4 weeks, and every 4 weeks is going to be effective in many of the patients. Some of them may have to go back to every 2 weeks. So fewer injections are also an advantage. And like dupilumab, tralokinumab, and I'd go as far as even lebrikizumab, which is another anti-IL-13, which is not yet FDA approved, they are not immunosuppressive. They are immunomodulatory. So older agents like methotrexate and cyclosporin and even anise kinase inhibitors fall under
immunosuppression. There is immunosuppression, even with Janus kinase inhibitors, that we have to factor in, though it certainly could be a lot less than something like cyclosporine. I personally feel that way. We do have to consider immunosuppression with Janus kinase inhibitors. With the monoclonal antibodies that we have for atopic dermatitis, they're more targeted and immunomodulatory. And so you don't have that particular issue of the immunosuppressive related considerations, and you don't need any baseline laboratory testing according to the label, which is important. And all of these things are not corticosteroids. You have to make sure that the patients know that, because if you give them a prescription for something new when they've only had corticosteroids, they might be thinking this is just another corticosteroid, and they have those fears about the chronic use of corticosteroids, which we don't have with these agents. Now, lebrikizumab, we're expecting it to be FDA approved also for atopic dermatitis. It's also very effective as an anti-IL-13. It has different binding characteristics than tralokinumab, so they're not identical, even though you have drugs in the same chemical class that are anti-IL-13. They are distinctly different, and they're distinctly different in many ways from dupilumab. So it's important to respect each drug individually. And lebrikizumab has very, very good data. And now that it's been evaluated a longer period of time, we have longer-term data with all of these agents, especially dupilumab, that was approved about 7 years ago. So I think the monoclonal antibodies are very, very important to look at individually. They can offer benefits. And there are even times where patients may have had difficulty with dupilumab, and maybe they had conjunctivitis that couldn't be managed. And some of those patients, there is data in the literature being treated with tralokinumab where they had very good efficacy and they didn't have the conjunctivitis, even though any of these agents can potentially cause conjunctivitis or be associated with it. Just because they had it with dupilumab doesn't mean they're going to have it with tralokinumab. And that's probably the same with lebrikizumab, though we're still waiting for the approval on lebrikizumab. These are very, very good medications for our patients, including the Janus kinase inhibitors. So we as dermatologists have to get smarter at drilling down to what's going on with our patients and giving the patients what we think are the best options and selecting the best therapy. Now, that brings us to another point of research that is not so much drug-related, but is very, very important. And there are people like Emma Gutman at Mount Sinai and many others that are looking at personalized medicine. And what does that mean? That means that you might have the ability to do a tape strip and then look at the profile, the genetic profile of that individual patient. And that profile, and even some of the biomarkers that we might find, let's say in blood tests, will give you more pinpoint direction to what drug or a few drugs that are going to work better in that individual patient. So you're not necessarily making the judgment based on the clinical history. All those things are going to be important, but the genetic profile of that patient is going to tell you they're not as likely to respond to XYZ drug, a monoclonal antibody that's more targeted, for example, but they're more likely to respond to this therapy. So from the outset, you're letting the patient know that you're selecting a therapy that's more likely to be very effective in them. So you don't have the trial and error aspect, which takes time, sometimes takes blood tests, and has expense. So the personalized medicine information is very important. There's also a product that utilizes basically a skin patch test that you apply to the skin that's available now that can help you predict for psoriasis whether the patient's going to respond better to a TNF inhibitor, an anti-IL-23 agent, or an anti-IL-17 agent. Maybe it'll tell you it will do better with all of them. But sometimes it's going to tell you which ones are more likely to be better. That will help you select therapy. And that's available now. So that's a very exciting part of it. I want to go over to a couple of other things before we finish. I do want to talk about molluscum contagiosum. We do have now an approved drug device. It's under the brand name of YCANTH, okay? That fortunately, they now have a designated J code. So when you utilize this in your office and you're electing to actually, at the time that you use it, purchase the drug, give it to the patient, but now get compensated for that component of it with a J code, from a business perspective, that's a very, very important advance. But the YCANTH is a drug device, and the device is a targeted applicator, and it contains a pharmaceutical-grade cantharidin, 0.7%. And it's the only cantharidin that we have that is manufactured from a supplier that is pharmaceutical-grade and is FDA-approved. So that's something you utilize in the office, typically apply to the lesions every 3 weeks, and you monitor the progress over time. It's still cantharidin, so they will get some stinging and burning. But because the tip allows for focal application, rather than putting it on with a toothpick or the blunt end of a wooden end of a cotton tip applicator, where you get spillage on surrounding skin and a lot more blistering, it's definitely a very effective therapy that has been studied with very good results in any areas where the patient has molluscum on their skin, keeping in mind you have to be at least 1 centimeter away from a mucosal surface. So the tarsal of the eye, the mucosa of the mouth, the mucosa of the perianal area, you have to be at least 1 centimeter away. But this is a very, very important advance. Also another agent for molluscum. So we now have 2 agents that are FDA approved for molluscum. This other one is different. It's berdazimer gel. It's not yet available commercially, but it is FDA approved. We're expecting it likely later this year or the beginning of next year. And it's a nitric oxide product. They figured out how to release nitric oxide, which we have in our body regulating a lot of systems. And one of the things that it does is it's antimicrobial, and it's toxic to the virus that causes molluscum. So they figured out a way that you could apply it. It gets released quickly because it is a gas that disappears quickly, but they figured out how to put it on a binder that when it's mixed with water, it's released, and they have efficacy data and tolerability data that did get FDA approval in the United States, applied at home. So it'd be the first FDA-approved agent that is prescribed, and it's applied at home. So that's something else to look forward to. I cannot forget hidradenitis suppurativa. Hidradenitis suppurativa is an extremely difficult disease to treat. It always has been. It's been very hard to help a lot of these patients that have these abscesses and sinus tracts and eventual scarring and tunnels below the skin that can drain and lead to scarring, typically in the axilla, the groin, on the breasts. A lot of times these patients are overweight. That's another difficulty that they have. And it's been very hard to treat these people. We've thrown antibiotics at them, intralesional therapy, but now we have monoclonal antibodies that are FDA approved. We've had adalimumab for a while, a TNF inhibitor, and recently secukinumab, which is an anti-IL-17. That's Cosentyx, which is approved for psoriasis. We now have it approved for hidradenitis suppurativa, and very, very effective. We also have data that's now been published on bimekizumab, which is an anti-IL-17A and F, where secukinumab is only A. Now, bimekizumab is FDA approved for psoriasis, right? We have had that out where You give 320 milligrams once a month, much more simplified dosing. Anti-IL-17 A and F, which has given us much greater efficacy, much quicker onset against psoriasis, even in comparative trials with anti-TNFs, right? With adalimumab, with anti-IL-12, 23, with ustekinumab, which is Stelara, and also compared to secukinumab, anti-IL-17 for psoriasis, which is Cosentyx, comparative data showing that the bimekizumab is superior to those early on and as you go out through the course of the study. Greater efficacy. We're now talking about PASI 90s and PASI 100, and after one dose, seeing about 80% reduction in PASI score, you know, early on, okay? Certainly by week 16, you get dramatic effect, but after a single dose, significant number of these patients show dramatic improvement. And that efficacy has gone out to 3 years now, being maintained. So no drop-off in efficacy for psoriasis. So that's been a major advance with bimekizumab. The biggest problem being you see a greater risk of oral candidiasis. You can see it with any of the anti-IL-17s, but it's going to be higher and usually managed with standard oral anti-candidal therapy. But now we have data on bimekizumab, not yet FDA approved. That was just published for hidradenitis suppurativa, looking at dosage finding and showing also extremely impressive results with that particular agent. We don't have comparison to the other agents yet with bimekizumab like we do for psoriasis. We don't have it with hidradenitis suppurativa, but another agent. So we're going to have more choices and we're helping these patients dramatically. So I think I'll stop there. There are many other areas we can talk about. There's vitiligo, there's alopecia areata, there's other topicals, there's other mechanisms of action. But you're probably tired of listening to Jim Del Rosso because I am right now. So I'm just going to wrap it up with one area I'm really looking forward to. In addition to the agents that are not yet approved that I mentioned, that we're expecting approval either this year or the beginning of next year, there's another pathway with a atopic dermatitis, and it likely is going to be involved with other diseases. It's the OX40 ligand pathway. And that's a unique pathway that's involved. Once there's active T cell activation, it's involved in augmenting the Th2 pathway, which is very involved in atopic dermatitis. So it actually, when you inhibit either OX40 or OX40 ligand, and that expression occurs after actual activation, you blunt that augmentation of that particular response pathway, but also appears to affect memory cells, which have to do with the continued progression of the disease or early relapse. So because memory cells are sitting around waiting for the next disease flare to incite. So this is going to be a very important pathway to look at. And I do not want to forget tyrosine kinase 2. We have deucravacitinib, which inhibits tyrosine kinase 2 more selectively, FDA approved as an oral Janus kinase inhibitor, but it does not affect Janus kinase 1, 2, or 3. So it does not have the box warnings of the other Janus kinase inhibitors. By being selective against tyrosine kinase 2, it is more targeted against the inflammation of psoriasis. So it does have that approval for plaque psoriasis. But tyrosine kinase 2 is being targeted with agents, including deucravacitinib, being looked at for other disease states. And lupus is a big one, both cutaneous lupus and systemic lupus. And we also have consideration for other disease states. So there's a lot to look forward to, and I've just scratched the surface of it. But hopefully I've given you a little entry into the mind of Jim Del Rosso and some of the things that excite him about dermatology. I do get excited about other things, I'm more than dermatology, but dermatology is embedded in my heart and my soul. So I hope this helps you.
Thank you again to Dr. Del Rosso for that enlightening conversation. For the latest in dermatology and all things healthcare, be sure to head to hcplive.com. That's it for this episode of HCP Live Podcast. Thanks for listening.